So today we have a guest from Saskatoon. Liz James is a Saskatoon Unitarian, mother of two boys, writer, student of Unitarian Universalism, singer, and blogger. We have enjoyed her talks here several times in the past. Liz studied at the Meadville Lombard Seminary in Chicago, but eventually decided that her path didn't match up to the seminary path for UU ministers. Since that time, she has put her education and insights to use, to writing about diverse topics such as mental health, walks around Saskatoon, spiritual lessons, and family life. Those of us on Facebook sometimes see her stories of her conversations with her boys. They're always really entertaining. Please welcome Liz back to Regina.
One of my favorite quotes is by E.B. White. It reads, "I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor it. This makes it hard to plan the day." This quote has been on a friend of mine's email signature for years, and email is the perfect spot for this quote because so often that's where I find myself stuck, in front of a computer screen when I would prefer to be outside watching leaves turn color. Leaves turn color was a good metaphor a week ago when I wrote this. It wasn't snow everywhere. But there is work to be done. I arise in the morning, torn between a desire to save the world and to savor it. It makes it hard to plan the day. Lately, the imp in the back of my mind has been altering this quote slightly to read, "I arise in the morning, torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to run screaming to a secure location, bury my head until I can neither see nor hear any of what is going on, and that makes it hard to face the day." Look, I'm about a minute and a half into my talk, and already a reference to Donald Trump is showing up in my mind. This would be the natural spot to insert a summary of everything bad going on and why it's so much worse than all the bad stuff that came before it, and then maybe lighten the mood with a Trump joke or two. I'm not going to do that. You already know the things I would list. You've probably already heard the jokes, and they're getting progressively less funny anyway. And that's not even our country. And also, I don't feel like talking about him. And also, I don't believe these things to be the cause of the pain I want to talk with you about today. I believe them to be a symptom. A couple of months before that fateful election, I remember attending a community organizing meeting around something to do with poverty and cuts to programs that alleviate poverty. I don't remember the details. An open call had gone out, and everyone with concerns about this issue was crowded into the back room of the Stand Community Organizing Center, and we were trying to plan a demonstration. And every time we started to make a plan, someone got up to talk about some issue or opinion that they were passionate about. We can't talk about poverty without also talking about gender or race, and about environmental issues, because the consequences of environmental degradation fall disproportionately on the poor. And when we march, and we always march, that shuts out people with disabilities. And when we organize using language that is not inclusive of non-gender binary people, we're forcing them to endure sting after sting in order to join us in the fight against poverty. The list of these things goes on. And all of these points that were being made are valid points, every single one. And yet when I kind of floated up above myself to watch what was going on, I saw that every time we started to progress towards a plan, someone got up and made a long and angry and justified diatribe of pain, and we got sidetracked. And I remember we thinking, we're not getting anywhere. Have any of you ever been in a meeting that went that way? I see sudden movement. And I found myself feeling judgmental of every sidetrack, thinking, this isn't your moment. Can't you just leave this so we can get something done? And then I was one of the culprits. I got up and gave my own diatribe. Someone had suggested that we have homeless people who were disproportionately affected by these cuts go be homeless in an encampment in a very visible place near a politician's office as a form of protest. As a formerly homeless person myself, I found this plan, well, impractical to start. It doesn't work that way. You can't phone up the leader of the homeless person's union and ask them to tell all the homeless people to go do something. Doesn't work that way. More than that, though, I found the plan objectionable. It treated homeless people like their lives and their challenges should exist and be manipulated for political purposes. It treated homeless people like things. So this idea had to be nixed. And so at the same time as I was judging others for sidetracking, I got up and made a speech to sidetrack someone else's idea. And I was right to do it. I think that idea had to be nixed. But it was also the case that we just weren't getting anywhere. And so I found myself sitting in this meeting, filled with an overwhelming sense of, I just can't do this anymore. I had found myself filled with that feeling a lot. Every time I sat down to work out a schedule or a budget or to answer an email or even write a blog post, I was filled with a feeling that I called sand in the gears. The wheels of my mind just wouldn't turn. And I would push them as hard as I could. Have you ever had that feeling in your social justice or caretaking efforts? Or just your efforts getting through the day? Does it sometimes feel to you like it's getting harder and harder to push towards your vision for the world as it gets increasingly cloudy? Now, my main work at the time focused around campaigns and organizing, with a heavy focus on social media. And our questions tended to be around pushing people harder. How do we figure out which actions will affect change? How do we get people to do those actions? How do we squeeze a little more fight out of people who are tired and distracted and want to stay home and binge watch Netflix? How do we make people care? It occurred to me that even as I was being judgmental about treating homeless people like things to be manipulated for just and good change, I was filling my days with treating people like things to be manipulated for just and good change. And when I say people, I include myself on that list, sitting at my computer with a brain that was desperately asking to do anything else, trying to squeeze one more push out of myself. I wish I could tell you that I had this epiphany and then I did better, but that's not what happened. Oh, I had the epiphany, all right, but it seemed an impractical epiphany to act on when I had so many things on my to-do list, so instead I just buckled down and pushed harder. Eventually, I ended up in the ER in the midst of what appeared to be a serious mental health crisis, but which I now refer to almost fondly as declaring spiritual bankruptcy. By spiritual here, I mean that thing that drives me. The term emotional bankruptcy or even schedule bankruptcy might make more sense to some of you. And all of these projects that I'd been struggling under, all of these projects that had become for me a source of a sense of my own worth, they were my value and they were gone. I had to resign from everything, the equivalent of a medical leave for depression, and my world narrowed down tremendously. I became very unimportant by all of my old measures. Every day I took care of my kids, and then myself, and then that was all I could do. When you declare spiritual bankruptcy, they give you the task of something they call self-care. Self-care means doing all those things you wished you'd had time for before, sitting in front of the fire with a mug of tea and a book, going on long walks, watching the snow fall, sitting and staring into space. All the things you'd have killed for a chance to do before the depression hit that would have brought you such joy, except doing them when you're depressed brings you zero joy because your joy is broken. So there's no point in doing them, and you're too tired for all that anyways, but you have to do them, so you do them, but with great resentment and not enjoying it even a little bit. And then the day comes when you realize that you are enjoying it just a little bit. It feels like when you're at that outdoor vigil in the winter and everyone's lighting candles, but it's still freezing, but if you put the candle right close to your cheek, you can feel a faint warmth. And at first it's barely noticeable, but it grows. And then you find one day you've woken up and gotten through the monumental challenge that is getting dressed and getting your kids off to school, and you're sitting reading and sipping tea by the fire, and the usual guilt that would accompany this moment is gone because you know you can't do much else anyways. You've been justifying this F every day by telling yourself this is self-care. Self-care is how you get back to being useful again. And then something clicks and you realize self-care is not about getting you back to being useful to people. It's about the fact that you are people, and people should not be treated like things. Self-care is about treating yourself like your own joy is meaningful and important and worth prioritizing. It's about sending yourself that message over and over again until you start to believe it. Now, this is a nice little story that I've told you. When I tell it, I have a warm, happy glow inside me, but I'm also aware of the fairy tale of it. I'm aware of some of my friends who are struggling under bills and crises and challenges that I don't have, who would say, tea by the fire and loving yourself, that sounds nice. And I'm painfully aware that self-care in our modern world is a too often co-opted term used to sell yoga pants and beauty products. But it didn't start that way. It originally began as a strategy with mentally ill patients and elderly patients in long-term care, teaching them skills that would lower the need for medical treatments. Didn't take long before medical personnel providing this advice began to realize it applied to them too. For people like trauma counselors and EMTs, it became clear that self-care was a necessity to keep workers able to do their job. Wasn't until the 1960s and 70s that self-care moved beyond a specific medical intervention for small groups of specific people. It gained greater popularity as women found that the medical system could be male-centered, prescriptive, and neglectful of them, and they began to take matters into their own hands. People of color and economically marginalized people, too, realized that the system was leaving them behind. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health is the most shocking and the most inhuman." The Black Panthers began organizing community clinics nationwide in the U.S., recruiting medical professionals and offering testing, community health programs, and treatments. In doing this, they centered themselves not only around political change, but also around directly providing people the resources and advantages that they needed to fulfill their own potential. By focusing not just on getting people out to march or protest, but also on addressing their imminent medical needs, they were treating people like people rather than like tools. Here in Canada, self-care was alive and well, but with different language. Indigenous people, for example, worked to preserve their own medicines and treatments, often in direct opposition to a government that didn't just fail to support those efforts, but that actively made them illegal and attempted to stamp them out. In my home congregation, a Métis friend of mine describes being ill as a little girl, and her mother furtively covering the kitchen table with a whole bunch of blankets and then putting her daughter in and bringing in all these kettles of hot water. And my friend now recognizes that as a carefully hidden miniature sweat lodge. For Indigenous people, self-care was often something passed secretly and with fear of discovery. It was intimately entwined with physical and emotional health, as well as with identity and with resistance. Audre Lorde later wrote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that makes it an act of political warfare." That bears repeating. Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it's self-preservation, which is an act of political warfare. I thought about this quote as I sat in my apartment during the medical leave that I had accessed so easily, sipping tea and reading by the fire. I thought about the woman who wrote this quote. Audre Lorde was born in the 1930s to immigrant parents in New York. She grew up as a person of color with severe visual impairments who would later come out as a lesbian in the 1950s. Although Lorde and I do share the identities of women and feminist, I think it's safe to assume that her experience of the world had a lot of challenges that mine has not. And when she talks about self-preservation as an act of political warfare, she may or may not have been referring to economically privileged white women like myself. Which brings me to the heart of the guilt. I have no problem justifying Audre Lorde's self-care, but how do I justify my own? How do I justify taking a break from the fight to heal and protect myself when I know there are others who don't get to make that same choice because the battleground is their own rights, their own safety, and their own bodies? When I know there are others who do not talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women as an important social issue, but as a pressing worry that makes them think twice about running to the store for milk at 11 o'clock at night. Do I have a right to tell myself I can't attend their vigil because I need to stay home and feed myself for my own self-preservation? Is that a fair thing to say? I can't tell you whether or not it's fair. I suspect it isn't. Nothing about this situation is fair. But I can tell you that it's necessary. It's necessary for three reasons. The first reason is that usual one about not being any good to others until you've taken care of yourself. This is the one that appeals to your sense of self-sacrifice. You can still treat yourself and others like things using this mentality. You're just a thing that requires regular tune-ups to stay on the road. But I don't want you to just be patched up enough to get back on the road. I don't want all the king's horses and all the king's men to slap some tape on you so that you can keep moving. I want you to be filled with joy. And not because you're more useful when you're filled with joy, although that's true, but because it's good and okay to find the joy where you can find it at the expense of the shoulds. In fact, prioritizing joy and reducing the tyranny of the should is a political act too, because at the core of wars, of reconciliation work that has come out of failed assimilation attempts, of environmental and degradation and rampant capitalism, at the core of these things is an ethic of treating living people and living creatures as though they are things. And so to change the world, we need to change that practice. We need to find a different rhythm and hold it steadily and unapologetically. If we aren't people of vision, even when it's cloudy, then we aren't people of vision. It's not a question of savoring the world or savoring it. Savoring the world is part of saving it. Failing to do this, treating ourselves as machines for the common good to be patched up and thrown back on the road, doesn't further the cause. When we do that, we end up in meetings that go nowhere, filled with tasks that are not meaningful. We end up in arguments about trivial things, thwarting and exhausting each other with unnecessary process and obligations. We end up doing the right things for the wrong reasons. Maybe correcting each other's language, but not in a, hey, did you know this wording feels a bit warmer and safer for people we want to include kind of a way, but more in an, I know better than you and I'm going to make you feel silly for using the wrong language kind of a way. And so we end up exhausted, desperate to be filled up, maintaining structures and practices that are more about tending to our own needs to feel right or important than about reaching the goals important to us. Now, I'm not saying that if we have enough bubble baths, we'll erase all the disagreements. Not at all. Pointing things out to one another is how we have each other's backs. But there's more than one way to point something out. When I'm most filled up, then I'm able to ask myself, am I speaking up here in this meeting to get someone out of trouble or to get someone into trouble? I also like to ask myself, this task I'm about to take on, what will happen if it doesn't happen? This cause here, is this a thing that I should work on specifically? What's my place? What is it about this issue that makes it mine? Because I know how much more I will get done on an issue that is mine for a specific reason than I will get done on some other equally important and valuable goal that doesn't speak to me. Sorry. The work ethic of grinding things out of myself repels people, and repelling people is a huge problem. Because the real answer to how do we get more people to work with us is that we have to embody something that attracts people, that is not grumpy. It's not enough to have great arguments about how right we are or how awful the world will be if people don't pay attention to our cause. We have to demonstrate visibly that something better is possible and encourage people to find their own unique calling to move forward with us. We can't do that if we're exhausted. We can't do that if we're treating ourselves and one another as things, and we can't do it while we're brittle. Brittle people do not create alliances well, and alliances are what we need. I want to share a story about an issue that's dear to my heart. For several years, I had a son who was gender creative. He doesn't identify that way anymore. In practice, this meant he looked very pink and very sparkly, and because he hadn't yet hit puberty, it also meant that he looked like he was absolutely, definitely, for sure a girl. And this didn't matter much in real life, but when we would travel, especially in the U.S., it was scary to send him into washrooms. Also, this trait in my son was bringing me into contact with parents of children who are transgender, and I was learning to love those children and empathize with those struggles. And so, as you might guess, on the issue of bathroom rights for trans people, to call me very opinionated would be a generous understatement. I pretty much felt that all people should get to use the washroom of their lived gender, and that anyone who disagreed with me, even slightly, was a transphobic bigot. So imagine how strange it was for me then to end up in conversation with a Muslim immigrant woman about how terrified she is for her daughter. Her daughter, who wears a hijab to cover even her hair from male eyes. This mother's position was that she was terrified at the very idea of her daughter in a change room with someone who has or has ever had male genitalia. No amount of logic would have worked on her. To tell you the truth, it wasn't logic that had worked on me. I came to my position on bathrooms by getting to know some lovely trans and genderqueer kids and growing to care about them and wanting them to feel safe and included. Logic doesn't reverse that kind of deep learning. This mom wasn't going to come up with arguments that satisfied me intellectually, because we see gender really, really differently, she and I. But spending time with her and her daughter left me more able to see the world of gender through their eyes. And it's not my worldview, but I do understand why it's theirs. And I want her kids, too, to feel safe and like their boundaries are being respected. Just not at the expense of anyone else's. This mother and I agreed on those points. which means we have a lot of work to do, a lot of work, as an entire society. Education work and lobbying work and policy work, sure, but also chatting work, striking up conversations at school potluck work, showing up for one another's kids' work, listening work, being comfortable with things being not quite so clear work, cloud work. This is not work you can do while you're tired. Whenever the logical arguments start flying, I have to ask, do you know the kids you're talking about? Can you see the world through their eyes? Do you love them too in some way? Do you want them to feel safe? Are you trying to win or are you trying to build something? Whenever the logical arguments start flying, I have to ask, does anyone here need a nap? And beginning to realize that to be a builder, you have to come from a place of flexibility and listening as well as a place of conviction. You have to love the kids, all the kids. And when we love the same kids, we're on the same team. We need ambassadors, not tireless people. And how you tell an ambassador is that they're not firing shots, winning for the sake of how it makes them feel. They're also not hiding, afraid to say the wrong thing or make people angry. They are often not sophisticated in the language of anti-oppression, probably because they don't spend a ton of time on their home turf perfecting their ideas through conversations with people who agree with them. They often bow out of conversations with people who are playing games or all agreeing with one another in favor of less entrenched and patterned discussions. They are in the trenches, covered in muck, carrying stories that don't get heard so much, translating, getting to know people so different from themselves that they know they are going to change and be changed. They are ready to fall if need be, ready to be cracked open, ready to find out about wings they didn't know they had. How you know ambassadors is by their questions. They are rarely questions that are settled by logical arguments. Answers to these questions unfold in the learning of each other's stories. How you recognize ambassadors is that they're doing work you cannot do if you are exhausted or desperate to be filled up. Self-care matters because it's how we get to our wisest selves, and we need our wisest selves. Activism does not demand that we be loud or right or endlessly energetic. It demands we be compassionate and able to listen, that we be the type of wise that draws others to us, that invites them to be part of creating something precious, invites them to learn from us and teach us, to join us in creating bonds not only of reason but of connection. Because that mother and I see gender very differently, but we are not adversaries. We care about the same kids, and that means we are on the same team. We don't get on the same team by any means other than compassion. Compassion for all of the people, ourselves included.
Thank you so much, Liz, for your sharing and your wisdom. And thanks for this talk today.